Hello there. Today is Monday, November 25th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, another billionaire enters the Democratic race to challenge President Donald Trump.
I just don't think people are going to buy it, that you just put a bunch of money, and maybe the argument is, hey, I've got more money than the guy in the White House. I don't think they're going to buy that. I think they want someone different.
Hong Kong voters come out in records to send a clear message to China. Also ahead, a bill to ban U.S. shark fin trade passes in the House and gets a step closer to becoming law. It's all on today's International Edition.
The Pentagon says Navy Secretary Richard Spencer submitted his resignation at the request of Defense Secretary Mark Esper, who it says had lost trust and confidence in Spencer because of a lack of candor.
The Secretary of the U.S. Navy has been fired over a case of a Navy SEAL facing a disciplinary proceeding. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
The Pentagon says Navy Secretary Richard Spencer submitted his resignation at the request of Defense Secretary Mark Esper, who it says had lost trust and confidence in Spencer because of a lack of candor over conversations with the White House involving the handling of the SEAL case. President Trump tweeted last Thursday that he would not let the Navy take away Chief Petty Officer Edward Gallagher's Trident pin, which designates him a SEAL. But at an international security forum Saturday, Spencer said he did not consider a tweet to be an order, and it would take a formal order to stop the Navy Review Board, which is set to meet December 2nd, to consider Gallagher's case. Gallagher was acquitted of murder in the 2017 stabbing death of a captured Islamic State militant in Iraq, but a military jury did convict him of posing with the corpse. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Well, voters came out in droves in Hong Kong's local elections with a record 71% of the city's 4.1 million registered voters casting ballots Sunday. Interest was high in the normally low-profile district council elections. Pro-democracy protests have continued, even as they've become increasingly violent. The main complaint about elections was long lines, some which extended out of polling stations for blocks. Joining us from Hong Kong is VOA correspondent Bill Gallo. Bill, I understand some of the results have already come in.
It was immediately clear that voting was very popular yesterday in Hong Kong, but it wasn't exactly clear what that large turnout would mean. It turns out, as we're receiving some initial results, that pro-democracy forces appear headed for a massive win. The initial results showed that most every pro-democracy candidate that had run was winning. That trend has continued. It's not quite as decisive, but as of now, we've seen 275, I believe, pro-democracy candidates win compared to about 40 pro-establishment candidates. So it's no doubt right now, unquestionably, Hong Kong voters have sent a message both to Beijing and to the Hong Kong government that things are not okay. They want change.
Will it actually make a difference? Will Hong Kong have the ability to actually make those changes that democracy seekers are looking for?
Well, that's the huge question here, actually, because these elections were for district council members, which are largely powerless. These are basically local politicians who decide things. They take complaints about excessive noise in the neighborhood or the location of bus stops, things like this. They have no power to pass legislation. The main reason this vote was important is that it was the first chance for Hong Kongers to vote since the massive pro-democracy, anti-government protests have taken place. Now, there is a bit more nuance to this in that in Hong Kong's quasi-democratic system, these district council members also have the ability to choose Hong Kong's chief executive, which is not directly elected. They also have the ability to run in legislative council elections, which that's the legislature here that is only half chosen directly by voters. So it's complicated. It could have implications for the future as it relates to the political dynamic here. But immediately, no, nothing has changed. The primary value in this is that it sent a big message to Beijing.
Whether or not they listen is probably less likely than anything at this point.
Yeah, we haven't really seen much response from Beijing so far. There have been some state media commentators in the mainland that have suggested there was Western interference, that all the media had come here and talked to pro-democracy forces and sort of ginned up anti-Chinese sentiment, which is an interesting strategy to take. But if you spend 10 minutes here, you'll find that there is widespread anti-government sentiment. It's not hard to find in Hong Kong.
Thank you. And speaking of elections, while 59 other countries have elected female heads of state, the United States has yet to shatter what former Democratic nominee for President Hillary Clinton called the highest, hardest glass ceiling. Clinton's loss to President Donald Trump in 2016 may have blazed a trail for five female candidates currently running for president in 2020. But as VOA's Brian Patton reports, it also reinforced doubts that a woman can be elected to the nation's highest office.
Looking back at her 2016 election defeat to President Trump, Hillary Clinton recently said gender stereotypes and sexism contributed to her loss.
There have been slights against women and all kinds of sexism and misogyny, so none of this is new.
Trump's treatment of women, from calling Clinton a nasty woman to regularly critiquing women on their physical appearance, combined with his anti-abortion judicial nominees and racially divisive pronouncements, helps spur a record number of women to run in last year's midterm congressional elections. Now multiple women are running for the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination. The contenders include three U.S. senators, Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts, California's Kamala Harris, and Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota. All face an electability hurdle specific to their gender.
We have a certain archetype for president in this country. It has always been a man. We think of leadership, and particularly presidential leadership, in a certain way. And women don't fit into that yet.
Female Democratic candidates can be particularly vulnerable to gender bias attacks that cast them as overly compassionate and not as tough as men in advocating causes like expanded health care for the poor.
That probably reinforces existing views of the Democratic Party, when sometimes to win that majority, you need to cut against the stereotype a little bit.
After the Clinton loss, some wonder if a male Democrat stands a better chance of winning over Americans who voted for Trump in 2016. But today's Democratic candidates reject any notion that now is not their time.
Putting more women in positions of power leads to progress. And it's not always easy, but you don't get what you don't fight for.
Another Democratic contender, former Vice President Joe Biden, recently criticized Elizabeth Warren as angry and unyielding. Warren responded in a campaign email saying, "I'm angry and I own it." Today's women candidates are not shy about calling out perceived sexist attacks or double standards in how they are portrayed.
I think it's opening everyone's eyes to, hold on, is that the way I would treat a male candidate? And that's good for all of us.
Recent elections indicate growing female support for Democrats, and polls show an erosion of support for Trump among women. Women will play a critical role in the outcome of the 2020 election, including whether a woman finally breaks the presidential glass ceiling. Ryan Patton, VOA News, Washington.
And former New York mayor and billionaire media mogul Michael Bloomberg has now jumped into the race, launching his Democratic presidential campaign with an ad praising his accomplishments and listing his goals for the country. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Michael Bloomberg officially launches his Democratic presidential campaign with an ad praising his accomplishments and listing his goals for the country. The ad begins with the announcer talking about Bloomberg and photos of the former New York City mayor over the years.
He could have just been the middle-class kid who made good, but Mike Bloomberg became the guy who did good.
9/11, gun control, and climate change, all examples of what the ad touts.
Now he's taking on him.
Bloomberg jumps into the Democratic primary late, reflecting his concern no current candidate can beat President Trump.
Mike Bloomberg for president.
I'm Mike Bloomberg, and I approve this message.
The ad is part of a $30 million TV buy. I'm Julie Walker.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at voanews.com. As the internet is restored, online protest videos show chaos in Iran. Boris Johnson, Britain's prime minister, promises a Christmas present Brexit push. At least 26 people have been killed after a plane in Congo crashes in a residential area. And better weather forecasts are coming to the developing world. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. People in Israel have expressed mixed reactions to the news that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel has been indicted on corruption charges. His supporters believe the charges are fabricated, and his opponents are calling for his resignation. Netanyahu is vowing to fight back, but it's not clear how long he can hold on to power after the indictment, VOA's Latika Hulk reports.
The embattled prime minister was defiant after Israel's attorney general announced the indictment Thursday.
This evening, we are witnessing an attempted coup against the prime minister with false charges and a contaminated and tendentious investigation process.
Netanyahu has been indicted on charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust in three long-running corruption cases. He is seeking to convince his supporters that the country's entire political system is affected by corruption and political bias.
I think you need to be blind in order not to see that something wrong is going on among the police investigators and the prosecution.
Netanyahu's supporters came out to protest the charges following the announcement.
I came to tell Netanyahu, you will never march alone. And I came to say that all of the fabricators of this ridiculous and abominable coup attempt won't succeed. Simply won't succeed.
But many Israelis say it is time for Netanyahu to resign.
It is unheard of, it is unthinkable that the prime minister will continue in office while being indicted for such grave breaches of law. He will stand trial, he will probably also go to jail. He cannot manage a country as difficult to manage as the state of Israel.
The longest-serving prime minister in Israel's history, Netanyahu has been unable to form a ruling coalition after two back-to-back elections this year. His indictment adds to the concern about the state of the country's leadership.
I am very disappointed that for a whole year we don't have a government. It's disappointing. I don't know what will be. I can't see that another election will lead to results that are very different. It's a little bit of a mess, but we'll see. This is a democracy. Eventually, things have a nature of resolving themselves.
Thursday's announcement further complicates Israel's paralyzed political system, in which neither Netanyahu nor his closest rival, Benny Gantz, has been able to form a government following Israel's second election in September. A third election could be held later this year. Zlatica Hoch, VOA News, Washington.
The U.S. House of Representatives passed legislation last week to ban the use of shark fin trade and now awaits final passage in the Senate. The demand for shark fins incentivizes shark finning, the cruel and wasteful practice of removing a shark's fins at sea and throwing it back overboard where it drowns, starves to death, or is eaten alive by other fish. And just as rhino and elephant populations have declined due to the demand for their horns and tusks, the shark fin trade is jeopardizing the continued survival of many shark populations. Joining us to talk about this just-passed legislation in the House of Representatives is Whitney Weber, campaign director with Oceana, a nonprofit ocean protection organization. Thanks for being with us. So it sounds like the shark fin trade has moved a step closer to being banned.
It is a major victory. Basically, it gets the U.S. out of the shark fin trade. And the problem with this trade is that the fins from up to 73 million sharks end up in this horrific trade every year. And it is driving a practice known as finning, which is the removal of the shark's fins aboard a vessel and then dumping the rest of the body back into the ocean, so just retaining the fins, which is just decimating shark populations around the world and obviously just a cruel and inhumane practice. So the U.S. has actually banned finning, but unfortunately we still import and export fins with other countries, many of which do not have similar protections for sharks in place. And so we end up with, you know, these finned fins in our marketplace and are none the wiser for it. So we really want to close this loophole and just say no to shark fins.
Are you saying that this is done to these animals while they're still alive?
Absolutely. Yes. It's horrible.
Why?
Well, the fin is often the most valuable part of the shark. It's used in a soup. It's considered a delicacy in some countries. It can go for up to $100 a bowl. And so the rest of the shark is often not as valuable, and they want to save space for the valuable part, so they just dump the body back into the ocean, and they die a very slow, painful, awful death.
Oh,
so
gosh.
The U.S. really needs to be a leader in this and close our doors to the trade completely. We were hoping to be the first G20 country to do so. Canada beat us to it earlier this year, but when the U.S. steps up to lead on issues like this, other countries follow, and we're really hoping to make it happen.
What countries are seeing the most demand for this product?
It's primarily out of Hong Kong, China, those areas, but again, we are still, you know, a participant in the fin trade. We actually have 12 states that have banned it at the state level, which is fantastic, but because we don't have a federal ban, the fins can still be shipped through interstate commerce. So we're seeing states like California that have had bans for years, but they're still able to get shipments of fins through their ports onto other countries or what have you. And so that's problem number one. Problem number two is that when one state closes its door to this marketplace, the state next door typically pops up with a whole new shark fin market that they didn't have before. So we just need a blanket federal ban.
Why does the world need sharks? Why does it matter that millions of sharks are on the decline?
Well, sharks are important in their own right. They've been here before the dinosaur, and we don't want to have any part in their rapid decline, which we are certainly contributing to. But they are also apex predators, and so they really are important for ocean ecosystems in that they manage the food web. So once you take out an apex predator, you just have chaos in the food chain below you. And then finally, you know, it is also kind of an economic argument. And we are seeing states like Florida that have a huge diving industry that will really be impacted by lower shark populations. And that we have folks that go out in this country and just want to see sharks. They go shark diving. In Florida alone, we actually looked at this, and shark diving, not, you know, snorkeling or I want to see a turtle, they want to go shark diving. Those folks are driving $221 million of direct expenditures into Florida every year. You talk about the hotels, the restaurants, and everything indirect, we're looking at $377 million. When you compare that to our national fin exports in 2016, that number is $850,000 total for the U.S. So you've got these people that rely on going out in the water and seeing sharks and diving with sharks. They're really seeing quite a significant difference these days than we used to be seeing in the water years and years ago.
All right, Whitney Weber, she is the campaign director with Oceana, a nonprofit ocean protection organization. Thank you for being with us. You're listening to International Edition, back in a minute.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, heads of state and governments of the six-member Central African Economic and Monetary Community, or CEMAC, are meeting in Yaoundé to foster regional integration and speed process in the economic bloc said to be the least developed on the African continent. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé that CEMAC development is slowed by the spillover of the Boko Haram crisis in the north of Cameroon. The carnage and political tensions in Cameroon, Gabon, and Equatorial Guinea have some of the world's longest-serving leaders.
Hundreds of merchants from Gabon and Equatorial Guinea
buy and sell goods at the Cameroon border markets of Kiosi, located on the boundary with the two neighboring states. They are discussing the heads of state of the Economic and Monetary Community of Central African States, CEMAC, which consists of Equatorial Guinea, Gabon, Chad, Central African Republic, Cameroon and Congo-Brazzaville. Cameroonian vegetable and fruit seller Amat Njimulu says he'd like to see free movements of people between CEMAC member states. He says between the western Cameroon town of Fumbot, where he comes from, and Gabon's capital Libreville, there are 68 regular police and customs checkpoints and about 30 other control points, which they have realized are illegally extorting money from commuters. In November 2017, CEMAC heads of states meeting in Chad said they had reached a milestone agreement to lift visa requirements for its citizens traveling within the regional bloc. But Gabonese-born Roger Ngembu, political consultant with CEMAC, says that except for the border between Chad and Cameroon, where citizens travel freely, nothing has changed. He says a survey they carried out this year on why CEMAC's growth is slow and projects are hardly implemented indicates that countries are reluctant to open up to each other due to security threats and corruption. He says it is imperative for CEMAC member states to make movement between its citizens visa-free so they can benefit from the opportunities their huge markets of close to 60 million people offers. The economic growth rate in Central Africa is barely 1.5%. The president of the Republic of Congo, Denis Sassou Nguesso, says the region needs to re-examine some of its policies to speed growth. Nguesso says for the sub-regional integration they have been asking for to be successful, he and his peers should first of all provide basic facilities like roads, rail and air transport, telecommunications and electricity infrastructure. He says they have to tackle corruption which is making their countries poorer. He says while waiting for funding to develop the infrastructure, he and Cameroon's President Paul Biya have decided to build a road linking the town of Pointe Noire in his country and Douala in Cameroon. CEMAC has plans to create a regional airline, roads that link the six countries, interstate hospitals and universities. But Ngembu said he doubts their ability to execute the plans with the ongoing economic, social and political tensions in the region. Cameroon, the region's main economic engine, is dealing with Boko Haram and a separatist crisis in two regions and tensions over Biya's 37 years in power. In Equatorial Guinea, an attempt last year to overthrow President Obiang, who has been in power for four decades, was foiled by his military. And the Central African Republic, yet to stabilize since rebels overthrew the president there in 2013. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon. Standing there, killing
time, can't commit to anything but a quarantine. Billie Eilish has picked up a new Artist of the Year at the American Music Awards after a fiery performance of her song, All the Good Girls Go to Hell. She sung surrounded by flames, both real and projected on giant screens. Eilish also won Favorite Alternative Artist earlier in the broadcast, thanking her creative team for letting her do whatever she wanted to do. She also sang with her brother, Phineas O'Connell, wearing an oversized shirt that read, "No Music on a Dead Planet." Eilish won the first televised award of the night for Favorite Alternative Artist. Taylor Swift, by the way, was nominated for Artist of the Decade. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com.
We thank you very much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Shirt now red, my bloody nose sleeping. You're on your tippy toes creeping around like no one knows. Think you're so criminal. Bruises on both my knees for you. Don't say thank you, oh please. I do what I want when I'm wanting to. My soul so cynical. So you're a tough guy, like you really rough guy. Just can't get enough guy, just always so puff guy. I'm that bad type, make your mama sad type. Make your girlfriend mad type, might seduce your dad type. I'm the bad guy. Duh.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For more than half a century since its founding in 1961, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, fulfilled its mission by sending to developing countries material assistance like food and medicine. When USAID was created, $3 out of every $4 that went from America to the developing world were government money, said USAID Administrator Mark Green. These days, that number is less than $1 out of every $10. Global aid needs are many and government funding will never be enough, said USAID Deputy Administrator Bonnie Glick. So we have to work with the private sector. What we can do from a government perspective is offer seed capital that then gets catalyzed by investors, said Deputy Administrator Glick. Yet there is more to it than just funding. We recognize that we do not have a monopoly on the good solutions, said Ms. Glick. There are great solutions that are generated everywhere on Earth. Take, for example, the 5-year Securing Water for Food, or SWIFT, and Powering Agriculture Energy Grand Challenges, which enrolled 80 innovators from more than 40 countries to develop more food with less water and use renewable energy more efficiently. The SWIFT innovators have helped 6.3 million farmers and their families produce nearly 6 million tons of food. They leveraged more than $20 million in additional funding through more than 300 partnerships, which helped reduce the need for future donor assistance for these innovations. They have also generated $6.5 million in sales, demonstrating profitability, demand in the market, and sustainability. That was just the first step. In late October, Deputy Administrator Glick announced that USAID and its partners, the Swedish International Development Cooperation Agency and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Kingdom of the Netherlands, will dedicate $35 million to kick off the Water and Energy for Food Challenge. This initiative, a logical expansion of the two earlier challenges, will increase sustainable agriculture, food security, and climate resilience in developing countries and emerging markets. It will focus on the poor and women by investing in small enterprise. We expect that that capital will increase. That will crowdfund an investment capital in at around $25 million, and then in the subsequent years it will scale up, said Deputy Administrator Glick. We're going to encourage organizations, individuals, to submit to us concept papers about how you would visualize a solution to the problem that we see around the world or in an individual country that are at the nexus of water, energy, and food. For more information, visit https://we4f.org.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm